All rise. Foyer, foyer, foyer. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Lawrence B. Hagel presiding. All who have business before this court, draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning, everyone. We're here today to hear two cases on the bond that we heard separately. So, just to let you know, and, as a result, I'm going to let counsel know that it will be, we will hold as closely as possible to the time limits for argument. We're oftentimes more liberal, but I think it's going in order to do this orderly and not too long. We're going to do that, so I appreciate counsel's understanding and to the extent you can to comply with that. The first case we're going to hear is Johnson v. McDonald. The docket number is 10-1785. We'll speak for Mr. Johnson.
Kent Carpenter, what program?
And we'll speak for the secretary.
Jessica Swartz and Ken Walker.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Carpenter? And I see that you reserve 10 minutes.
10 minutes, yeah. Thank you very much. May it please the court, Judge Hagel, members of the court, Chief Judge Hagel, excuse me. The VA has not, and I do not believe can, meet its statutory burden to show this court that both at the administrative level and at litigation level, that their positions at either were substantially justified. To begin with the VA's position at the administrative level, it is found in the board's decision at pages 15 and 16 of the RVA. There are only two sentences, actually three sentences, that discuss the question of the service-connected disabilities that Mr. Johnson has. And they omit a discussion of one of his service-connected disabilities. The conclusion drawn by the board was that there was no legitimate grounds to consider the assignment of an extra schedule of rating to include a referral of this case to the Director of VA Compensation Services for extra schedule consideration. The board, as a consequence, offered no justification, no explanation whatsoever for why they failed to consider the collective impact of Mr. Johnson's multiple service-connected disabilities. No justification can be offered by the VA in order to avoid their liability under EJIA because it is bound by the decision made by the board. In other words, this court must look to what the board said, and then the VA must, under their statutory burden, come forward with a showing as to why that administrative position was substantially justified. The VA claims in its response to Mr. Johnson's EJIA application that at each stage, the agency based its decision on prior determinations that Section 3.321B was ambiguous. This statement is ambiguous because there is no indication as to what prior determinations the VA is referring to. There are no existing precedent of this court or any other court that support the notion that this statute, excuse me, this regulation was ambiguous, nor is there any indication that there is a VA general counsel's opinion that made such a determination. So what the VA is really saying is that they made their own apparent interpretation of this regulation to have meaning that they ultimately took.
Even if VA had a general counsel opinion, if the Federal Circuit determined that the plain meaning of the regulation was different than that general counsel opinion,
it were a presidential opinion and the board had cited that presidential opinion as their justification.
No, the Federal Circuit.
For counsel, for this is only at the administrative level. Do not misunderstand that that deals with the litigation level. So as to the administrative level only, I believe that if there existed such a presidential opinion, then I believe the board could have been substantially justified in following that, because there's
is
a statute.
Is it the board that has to be substantially justified or the agency?
Well, I'm not sure.
The board is an independent tribunal within the secretary and makes the final decision for the secretary. But it's the agency that is ultimately making the decision.
I'm not familiar with any case law that makes that distinction, either by this court or any other court. But the point is well taken that if you broaden it to the agency's position, then that encompasses the interpretation that they made. But the question is in assessing that position, where was it articulated? And the only place that it is articulated for this court to review is within the four corners of the board decision. So I think in the context of EJU, when we're talking about the VA's administrative position, that is the position that is taken on one review by the Secretary, by the Board of Veterans' Appeals, of the Secretary's underlying decision. So regardless,
that's why I asked it, because ultimately if you had a general counsel opinion and the board followed that opinion, you're suggesting that that would be substantial justification, which, not to get too far into another case, but when a court rendered an opinion and the board followed the court's opinion, would that be substantial justification? But you don't have to answer that one because that gets into the next one.
Mr. Carpenter, do we have any indication in the record that the issue of consideration of aggravated disabilities under 3.321 was raised at the board?
No.
Would the board then have an obligation to discuss whether or not it applied to aggravated disabilities if it wasn't raised?
Well, yes, because they were applying.
I'm sorry. What was your answer to that?
Yes. Yes, that they would have had an affirmative obligation to address 3.321B because they relied upon that for their determination that there was no legitimate grounds for referral. The board has an obligation under 7104D to explain the reasons and bases for their actions. And in my view, and that was the decision that was taken in the original briefing in this matter, that there was an inadequate statement of reasons or bases for why they didn't consider all of Mr. Johnson's service-connected disabilities.
If I could, I want to make sure I understand where we are in our argument. First of all, do you believe there is any difference of opinion about whether Mr. Johnson is a prevailing party?
No.
Okay.
The government has conceded that. I believe it's off the table.
Okay. So what you're talking about then is whether or not VA was substantially justified, and you're talking about now at the administrative level.
That's correct. That's correct.
Now, and am I correct in assuming that what you're addressing now is what I would call one of the first sort of factors set forth in Stilwell? In other words, Stilwell says there are several factors, not just one, that we need to consider to determine substantial justification. Which of those factors are you addressing right now?
Well, I'm addressing not so much the Stilwell factors as I'm addressing the VA's burden under Title 28, under the EJU statute, to come forward with a showing, and that they have made no showing as to why the administrative decision taken was reasonable.
But wouldn't that go to the merits of the decision?
No, Your Honor.
decision was wrong for whatever reason, isn't your argument that the board, the agency position was not substantially justified in its conclusion? Not regarding this issue.
Well, that is certainly my position, Your Honor, but with all due respect, Congress in the prevailing party put a burden on the appellant. They flip that burden on substantial justification.
I understand.
So the government has to come forward. So it's not a question of whether I think.
I mean whether or not it's the Secretary's responsibility. And not the Secretary's responsibility, but I'm talking about what you're arguing itself. If you wouldn't mind, could we talk about one of the other factors in Stillwell? Or the other factors, I'm sorry, not necessarily in Stillwell, but that instruct us about how we are supposed to determine the totality of the circumstances to see whether or not VA is substantially justified.
And what I'm suggesting to you is that there are no other factors at the administrative level, because at the administrative level, when this court looks to what the board wrote in its decision, there is no basis for this court to understand why they acted in the way in which they acted. If they had offered an explanation, then the government could come forward and say that we rely
on... Regardless of what explanation they had, didn't the Federal Circuit say that this was the meaning of this regulation required an assessment of whether extra schedule considerations should be considered?
They did.
Based on multiple disciplines, that was the plain meaning. Didn't they also say they saw no policy reason for the Secretary's position? So regardless of the general counsel's decision, regardless of anything the board might have said, they were not substantially justified.
And that takes the view that when we're dealing with an interpretation of a statute or a regulation, that the litigation position is inextricably intertwined with the administrative position. And under that broader view, I think you're absolutely right. But the case law has not made a clean distinction between administrative position and what that constitutes.
Well, that's because the case law doesn't have a lot of plain meaning interpretations. I mean, when you get to a statute or regulation, and the Federal Circuit has said the plain meaning is A, then, regardless, what action could have been taken by the agency in its administrative or litigating position?
And I'm in agreement with that assessment, particularly as it relates to the litigation position. I'm simply trying to respond to what I believe is the failure of the VA to meet its burden, and that ends the matter because they have to be substantially justified in both. And since they're not substantially justified in the administrative position, then I believe this case can be disposed of by simply recognizing that no demonstration has been forthcoming from the VA as to why their administrative position was substantially justified. But I would like to move to the litigation position so that we can discuss that. The litigation...
Does the M21 provide any guidance that you wish to have from your standpoint?
It could have been a factor had the board cited to it, but the board did not cite to it, and therefore, in my judgment, it is a non-factor. That goes back to the reasons and bases analysis that without any explanation for what they did other than declaring what they did, this court has no way of knowing what justification they relied upon for taking that action.
Had the board cited to it, they would have ended up with the same interpretation that the department has.
That would be correct. And that's why I was saying to Judge Castle that I believe that those two can be considered inextricably intertwined. That is to say, the litigation position, because after all, the litigation position is premised, or excuse me, the administrative position is premised on the litigation position that they ultimately took, that they made a interpretation. And that...
Please continue. Which administrative position are you talking about?
The administrative position that the board had no obligation to consider the collective impact.
Which board decision?
The board decision. decision that was appealed by Mr. Johnson to the court, to this court.
So you're talking about the board decision on remand?
That this court is now remanded? Yes, Your Honor. Yes, but I'm sorry, I was talking about the original court decision.
Yeah,
okay. The litigation position was based upon the VA's interpretation that their own regulation, which had been in effect since 1961, was ambiguous. That litigation position did not prevail before the Federal Circuit. In order to avoid liability under the Aegis statute, the VA must be able to show this court why that position, that interpretation of ambiguity in their own regulation was both reasonable in law or fact. They have made no effort to address that issue. Their responses focus on essentially...
Because they can. The Federal Circuit already said there is no ambiguity. You would really have the Secretary come in here and say the Federal Circuit was wrong? I mean, they just didn't have an argument. It's a plain meaning. So don't make them mad, guys, because they're not making an argument they can't make.
Well, forgive me, Your Honor, but to use your term...
Or if you want to argue for them, go ahead.
Well, no. What I'm suggesting is that in order to take the position that they've taken in this post-litigation on the question of Equal Access to Justice Act fees, they are taking the position that their litigation position was substantially justified. When they take that position, Congress has imposed a burden on them to show why that position was reasonable. And in this case, they must do so, as you suggest, a quite formidable burden to demonstrate why they were still reasonable.
Well, in fairness, they're talking about a number of briefings that were submitted to the court, the fact that this court rendered a decision in their favor, a split decision. I mean, they have presented those facts.
And with all due respect, Your Honor, that's not their litigation position. Their litigation position was ambiguity. Those other facts are about why this court deferred. This court, once it deferred, based upon finding of ambiguity, you had to look to determine whether or not the interpretation made by the VA after they made the interpretation of ambiguity was reasonable. Was it reasonable, given the ambiguity of 3.321B, to consider disabilities individually? This court agreed in a divided decision that the regulation was ambiguous and that this court would defer. But what you deferred to is not their litigation position. What their litigation position was that the regulation itself was ambiguous. And they have offered nothing in their response to assert that they were substantially justified to explain why that position was reasonable in light of the Federal Circuit's decision to the contrary.
Counsel, I'd like to move on to your argument. I think it was with regard to both the Secretary's position on VA's position at the agency and in litigation that regarding what I'm calling the Patrick principle, that whenever a law is interpreted by a court, that's what it's always meant.
Correct.
Are you aware of any case where that's been applied specifically to the substantial justification prong of EJA?
Only in Patrick. That's the only case I'm aware of where that was applied.
Well, and so you read Patrick as applying it specifically to substantial justification.
I do. And more importantly, Your Honor, I believe this court in 1998 in Brewer actually also adopted the notion of retroactivity for judicial decisions. And that once you understand or accept the proposition that judicial decisions are retroactively applied, and under the Rivers case from the Supreme Court, the meaning of that judicial construction was what, in this case from 1961, this regulation always meant. And if that's the case, then there isn't any question that that is the basis for the Patrick Holden. And one of the problems in this court's case law is the lack of precision in describing change of law. This court has heretofore accepted as a given that a change in law includes a judicial interpretation. And a change in law based upon an enacted statute or a newly created regulation, unless it provides for retroactivity, is not retroactive. Conversely, a judicial construction is retroactive, and consequently, the decision that is made has, or excuse me, the decision in EJIA has to be made within the context of the interpretation brought forward by the VA, in this case that its own regulation was ambiguous. Why is that interpretation, why should this court now consider that interpretation to be reasonable in light of what the Federal Circuit did?
Are you saying, Mr. Carpenter, then, that once a higher court has decided that it is a matter of law, that some, the VA regulation is plain on its face, that that is the end of the matter?
I am, Your Honor, but I don't want to mislead you that it has to be, as it was in this case, part of the same appeal process.
So you're saying that there is no totality of the circumstances analysis left once the higher appellate court says that the regulation always meant X?
I'm not going quite that far, Your Honor. What I'm suggesting is that if the government had in fact come forward with any explanation to this court as to why its litigation position was reasonable, it could have implicated the totality of circumstances. But since they did not come forward, that's the end of the discussion under each.
So what you're saying is that, to clarify, and now I think I'm going to make the same wavelength with you, what really happened here is VA failed to meet its burden under each.
Yes.
In both. As to both the administrative level and the litigation position.
Yes.
That is the crux of the argument.
Perhaps we could explore this on the level that we are interested in. Would you?
No, I'm not going to chase it any further.
I'm sorry.
I'm done.
Okay.
And I acknowledge my content. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chief Judge Hagel, Your Honors, may I please the court. The court should reaffirm the existing case law relating to substantial justification based on the finding that the totality of the circumstances demonstrated that the Secretary was substantially justified both in his administrative and litigating position in this case. As an initial point, it's important to remember that the question of substantial justification is not whether the Secretary's agency position or litigating position is right or wrong. That has already been determined, as Judge Caswell has said, by the Federal Circuit. The question now is whether a reasonable person would believe that the Secretary had a reasonable basis in
the law. When you say the Federal Circuit, when they say that it's, and I'm going to just paraphrase, it's hard then to envision a case where the agency is not following the plain meaning of its regulation and be substantially justified. What do you say to that? And I think that's a fair statement from Patrick.
I think that's exactly what I think Patrick tells us.
Yes, Your Honor.
To me, is very important, too.
Yes, Your Honor. As the Patrick case recognized, it is not a dispositive factor. The Patrick case said it would be difficult, as both of Your Honors have said, to find that case. To find that substantially justified, but it's important to remember that in Patrick we had a different situation than what we had in this case. In Patrick, there was a statute specifically addressing the issue. There was legislative history of the statute explaining what the statute meant, and there was a general counsel opinion that went against the Secretary's interpretation in litigation. None of those factors was here in this case. And additionally, it is a totality of the circumstances finding. So even if that situation was one of the factors that goes against the Secretary submitted, there are are numerous other factors in favor of finding him substantially justified.
How do you say that against the federal circuit's finding that there were no policy basis, there's no policy basis for the decision to start to do?
In the Johnson case, yes. In the Johnson case, the federal circuit did say that. However, what they were referring to was the phrase, I believe, that in the language of, I think it was, apologize to afford justice, was the phrase that they were looking at for the policy determination. Now, there's two points there. One, that is not necessarily, that wasn't the holding of the case, that they made their holding regarding the language of the regulation. Then they went to say, even if none of this happened, there's no policy to, quote, afford justice. The Federal Circuit didn't get into any of the Secretary's explanation for why he has consistently believed since 1930 that this applies to individual disabilities.
But, to quote another court opinion, the fact that the VA has consistently applied this regulation in this manner, despite what the Federal Circuit found was a clear language without any support in the regulatory history or any other support that they can find, why doesn't that fit within the concept of VA regulations for over 70 years that aged nicely without judicial review?
Again, this is only one of many factors, but the Secretary would submit that this, in the circumstances of this case, this still goes in the Secretary's favor, primarily because this regulation was written in 1930 as part of the VA rules and procedures. It was not initially part of the APA requirements for notice and comment. It has been the same since then. The Secretary has consistently interpreted it the same since then. But more importantly, it had never been questioned until this case before this court.
And so, wait a minute, the court is about. What about Barber, for example? That was the first time that the regulation about 1151 was questioned. Isn't that the whole reason that this court was created to look at those things?
Absolutely, Your Honor. But the point to remember is that the Secretary should be able to assert his reasonable litigating and agency positions and to defend those positions before the court without subjecting.
Adjective there was reasonable.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And that's only one of the factors, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Would you mind addressing some of the other factors?
Yes, Your Honor. One of the primary factors in this case is that there was a genuine dispute as to both the meaning of the regulation and whether it was ambiguous. As this court found the Federal Circuit found in the Bates case, that is an important issue. If there is a genuine dispute within the panel of the court, or in this case, the en banc court, or between the courts deciding it. Secondly, another factor is that the en banc court here agreed with the Secretary's position. Again, while not dispositive and not indicative of right or wrong, it is indicative of whether that position was reasonable. Third, as we already addressed, there was the longstanding VA policy, which is something for still well this court can consider as one of the factors. Fourth,
the policy as it is in 21 or someplace else.
That was more of the generic term of the policy, but what's important to look at in this case is that VA's policy was written and had to be consistently followed throughout the course of since this regulation or prior to it being a regulation.
I'm sorry, where was it written?
In the M21 era. But it was also more of the general policy considerations of the law and still laws that they were considering.
Are you suggesting the M21 said that you could only provide an extra schedule rating or consideration on an individual disability basis?
Yes, Your Honor.
That was showing where it says that limits it to that.
If you look, Your Honor, and all this was set forth in our pleadings before the Court of the Merits determination, but it initially began in 1975, where they referred to consider inadequate for disability and used added the IES at the end of it. And then in 1992, we changed it to eliminate, to specifically say it's considered to be inadequate for an individual disability, again, adding the IES after disability. In 1997, we removed the IES from the end of the word disabilities, and now it says only inadequate for due to disability singular.
And does it say it limits it to that, or does it say should refer to that? I don't recall any limitation in N21.1 that says you may not refer for extra schedule consideration based on multiple disabilities. What I saw in there is that you can refer based on individuals. It is, I heard you say that the M21 said you can't do it.
I guess I may have misspoken, Your Honor. It's not that you can't refer it, because that, again, is the litigation position that the Secretary took in the merits. It's multiple disabilities may be preferred, but the consideration of whether an extra schedule rating is
the M21 does not state that you cannot refer based on multiple disabilities, does it? And if it does, you can show it to me, but I don't recall seeing that.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe I was referring to awarding the extra schedule rating. Yes, Your Honor. But going back to the other factors at play here is the fact that the court here has previously found that there was ambiguity surrounding 3.321B. And again, you look to Herman Gordon VP, the clarity of the regulation being questioned. So there are cases in which if the court found that there was a clear interpretation or the plain language ruled and ruled against the government for substantial justification, where it found that the language of the regulation was so clear, no reasonable person could have questioned what it said. And one of those is the Little Hobbs case from the D.C. Circuit. However, there's other cases, primarily Owen, again in the Federal Circuit, and a number of cases here in this court, where the court has found the regulation as plain on its face was contradictory to the statute, but still found the Secretary substantially justified in taking his position.
I'd like to interject a little bit, going back to the question of ambiguity. In your pleadings on the EJIA portion of the case, you talked about this regulation as a confusing tapestry, and even assuming that we would apply that term to this as opposed to TEIU, it's been used in the past. If VA perceived this regulation to be a confusing tapestry, how long does the agency get to rely on a regulation being ambiguous and confusing as a shield in the EJIA portion of the case in perpetuity? Or does the lack of action in clarifying the regulation undermine the reasonableness of the Secretary's position?
Your Honor, it's unlikely it would be in perpetuity, but a couple
but 25 years is okay.
It's all right, Your Honor, it's a debate. The point that we remember here is that those cases we're talking about the entire scheme of 3.321, as you pointed out, it refers to a comparative detention, TDIU, this case. It's also important to remember that in this case, the Secretary's position initially was that the language was clear of the regulation.
But in the alternative. So you also argued ambiguity.
Yes, as an alternative. But the Secretary didn't see there being any ambiguity in 3.321B such that he needed to change anything up until this case. And in fact, that's demonstrated by the attachment to one of the pleadings below from the Director of the Compensation Service, where he stated...
How important is that? I mean, it seems to me the Secretary had regulations in the Gardner case and argued all the way to the Supreme Court that they could do what they were doing, etc. And through three judicial courts, was told no. So yes, you have that position, but what effect does that have when the Superior Court says that the plain meaning is against the Secretary's position? I'm having a hard time following this argument that, oh my gosh, it's ambiguous, or excuse me, it was clear, it's ambiguous, and now it turns out it's clear the other way.
And not only is it clear, but there's no rational reason that the Secretary can conclude that way, because there's no policy history of this. The Federal Circuit's view
somewhere, we don't know where, but we're looking at the language, and it's clear.
Yes, sir. Again, that's going back to the question of right versus wrong. The Secretary, at this point, the Department of Justice chose not to appeal Johnson. It's back down here. It's back in the system. We are not disputing that the litigation position was wrong, hence why the Secretary conceded to prevailing party. The question is, where is the Secretary reasonable in taking that position? And, you know, just to kind of go back to the question Judge Moorman was asking of my colleague, the question was never raised in the record. The board specifically found that the only one of the appellant's disabilities that had any symptomatology was his knee disability. So this wasn't a situation where there were three or four symptomatic disabilities where it would have been raised to the board. There was nothing to even bring this question to them that it should have considered the effect of combined disabilities because there was no effect.
I got a red herring. I mean, the position of the agency was you didn't do it on a multiple disability basis. So what the board was going to figure that out anyway. It's almost like telling, okay, court, now you can look at these facts that the board kind of addressed around and you don't have to remand for prejudice. I suppose you can make that type of an argument. The fact of the matter is the agency's position was that it was clear or ambiguous. And there's no reason to believe the board had any other, or would have ever held it for you, isn't
it? Not necessarily. I don't understand that was our position, but it goes to, again, the totality of circumstances. And as you suggest, it also goes to the prejudicial error. Again, all of that, of course, is on the merits. It goes to Mr. Carpenter's argument that there was no basis for the board's decision. And one thing to point out there, too, is this court has seemed to, in the past, identify a quote-unquote reason or basis there. Again, not the Secretary's conceding that there was one, but as a sole factor for substantial justification. From the Supreme Court on down, they have said there is no dispositive factor. There is no single factor, and you must look at the totality of the circumstances. So even, Your Honor, if that was true, that there was some reasons or basis error in the board decision, that is not enough to determine substantial justification for the agency.
So you mentioned a case earlier, and I'm sorry I didn't get it down. It's probably going to be briefing, but Roe Models, the D.C. court?
Yes, Your Honor.
What was that case?
That is Roe Models v. Bromley, 353 F. 3rd, 962.
And that was a case, if I understood you correctly, that said it was clear on its face?
Yes, Your Honor. They were looking in that case that the agency had ignored the Department of the Army had ignored regulations regarding, I believe it was a contract to buy an Army base that was being closed. And they found that the agency ignored those regulations, and that those regulations were so clear on their face, both the regulation in question and the ones surrounding it, that no reasonable person could ever have found that it meant anything other than what they meant, that they found that it meant. And that's clearly not the case here, as we've got a panel of eight distinguished judges, Judge Greenberg voting on the original one, debating that very question. So again, the issue is not who was right or wrong. The issue was it a reasonable position to take? Going back to a question
that... So your position that if this court took a view that a regulation or a statute was ambiguous, that insulates you?
No, Your Honor. None of these are dispositive factors. That is a factor. That is a factor that in this case should weigh heavily, given that it was an en banc decision of this court that was then overturned by a panel at the Federal Circuit. The natural hierarchy of the court system means that they're finding holes. But there is a case, and unfortunately I don't remember the name of it, where I believe the Supreme Court said if there was a super Supreme Court, chances are many of our decisions would be overturned. It's just the nature of the hierarchy.
Yeah, that's Justice Jackson. We cited him a couple times.
Yes, Your Honor. I would like to go back to a question that Chief Judge Hagel asked my colleague over here about the Stilwell factors. The Stilwell factors define what substantially justified means in the statute. So yes, we cited the statute, but as the Supreme Court said in Underwood, substantially justified hasn't been defined. They defined it, the Federal Circuit defined it further as the totality of the circumstances, and this court defined it for the specific circumstances that apply to cases here.
that accounts for us. Let's take out for the moment the fact that the court has previously upheld the erroneous interpretation of the regulation and in the Patrick case at 1332, of course, Patrick holds that whether or not the position adopted by the government comports with an existing precedent. It was an important fact, but the fact that the Veterans Court had previously upheld VA's erroneous interpretation of Section 10111 does not resolve the substantial justification inquiry. And then it goes on to cite actually the role models case that you referred to as well. Take that out, that the court hadn't been a part of that. What are the other totality of the circumstances factors that would lead or help us conclude that, in fact, the government's position was substantially justified?
Some of those, it would go back again to the prior cases of this court, not Ian Johnson, but the prior one identifying the ambiguity in the regulatory structure surrounding 3.321. Therefore, again, pointing out the question that this could be ambiguous, therefore it's a reasonable position to take for the Secretary as an alternative to say, this is ambiguous, you need to look at the rest of our policy. And in fact, this exact question was raised in Brantley. And the court was aware of the concurring opinion, obviously, and chose not to adopt it at that point. So the Secretary was reasonable, again, in believing that his interpretation here was correct. The other factors...
I think that's what Judge Sheldon's point, that he just sat there and left this regulation out there with this court questioning its interpretation and your alternative argument being that it's ambiguous.
It does go to the perfect question, Your Honor, but as this court noted in its Johnson decision, the court has never adopted the Brantley as a concurring, or excuse me, as fact.
Well, did the court ever get that issue presented to it before the Johnson case?
It has, Your Honor. There were actually two memorandum decisions on that case, both by Mr. Bates brought the same argument and was brought here. And in both cases, the court found for the Secretary.
On that specific issue?
On that specific issue.
In 2 minutes?
Yes. I can get that for you if you'd like, Your Honor. Going to some of the other factors in response to Judge Davis's question, a consistent litigating position is one of the factors. So although this is slightly different from the fact that this regulation has been around since the beginning of time, essentially, a consistent litigation position is one of the factors to evaluate, regardless of what the ultimate success of that position was. I also wanted to go, Your Honor, to Judge Davis, to one of the questions that you asked my colleague here about the M21. The board is bound by the findings, by the policy of VA, set forth in the M21, set forth in the regulation. It doesn't necessarily have to cite to a specific regulation that's not raised by the record or policy. And so in this case, this wasn't raised by the record. It cited to Thune, which cited itself to this regulator, the M21.
Does the M21 actually bang the board or only the regional office?
Well, Your Honor, there's two different regulations. There's one that says the regulation, the board is bound by the regulation. There is another regulation addressing the board that says they're not bound by circulars and some of those other things. The M21 kind of falls in the middle there, but so it's not necessarily, may I have a moment? So essentially, as I was saying, they're not necessarily bound by the M21, but they have to follow the Secretary's interpretation. The M21 sets forth the Secretary's interpretation.
So just to summarize, is the government's position then that regardless of how strongly worded a higher court position is with regard to the clarity of the regulation, that can never be the end of the issue with regard to EJ?
As the case law has been set forth by the Supreme Court and the Federal Circuit and Secretary Smith, there's no reason to change it now. It is not dispositive.
So we have to go back and look at the totality of the circumstances and determine whether or not there's substantial justification for the government's position, notwithstanding how strongly any court may have spoken on the issue, the merits issue.
Yes, Your Honor. The courts have been very clear that whether the position is ultimately found right or wrong, to include the plaintiff, whether it was plain on its face, is not a dispositive factor. It can certainly be entitled to a certain amount of weight, possibly more weight than some of the other factors, but it is not a dispositive finding, Your Honor. It's also
with the fact that this court stands in kind of a unique position in that, unlike a district court, where another district court may reach a totally different result on similar facts, or unlike one of the numbered circuits, where the circuits may reach different decisions on the same or similar sets of facts. Here, when we speak, absent review by the Federal Circuit, we speak as to the whole of veterans' law. Does that make a difference?
Yes, Your Honor. Secretary Smith, that it does make a difference. As experts in this area of the law, in identifying situations where a labor regulation is plain on its face, or identifying a situation where the Secretary's interpretation and policy reasons behind the regulation was reasonable, as was identified in the en banc decision, certainly, Your Honor, that definitely is one of the factors to consider. It's also important to know that in the Johnson decision, although the Federal Circuit said it was plain on the face, the regulation doesn't say combined. It doesn't say collective. The Federal Circuit read that into the regulation. So they did their own interpretation of the regulation.
The statute does say combined, however, doesn't it?
1155? 1155, I'm not really sure, yes. Yes. But 3.321B, the regulatory, the statutory support for that is 501. So it follows 1155, but if you look in Westlaw and in the books, the support, the statute for that is 501. So
I think the Federal Circuit said that their interpretation, that it was clear on its face, was not inconsistent with 1155.
Your Honor, in rereading that, it almost looks like they did say it comes from 1155, even though it is the statutory authority was, but yes, Your Honor, it's also.
Is it also true that your position is not inconsistent with 1155? As to the meaning of the writ?
Yes, Your Honor. The Secretary would submit it does because 1155 goes to the individual rating criteria. Now, that again is getting a little bit more into the merits of the argument, whether the Secretary was right or wrong in that determination, not whether it's a reasonable position to take.
And so may I ask, if that's the case, if it's a reasonable position, who's a reasonable person then?
I bet the Federal Circuit says it's not.
It's probably a fair matter.
I didn't mean to put you on the spot, but that's what we have, is a reasonable man standard, a reasonable person, a reasonable expectation.
Yes, Your Honor. As to this reasonableness before the agency, I believe it was, forgive me if I'm not finding the case right now, it was Chu v. U.S., the Federal Circuit case, that said it's the reasonableness of the agency officer taking the position. So that's the one you need to look for the agency. As far as the litigation position...
Before you go, what was the point you were trying to make with regard to the board and whether or not the issue was reasonably raised? The issue of extra schedule consideration on a multiple disability basis was reasonably raised to it.
Just that the board in its discussion of extra scheduler consideration for this case specifically found that the heart disability had no symptoms.
What was the reason this case was remanded? Was it error?
Remanded back to the board? Yes, Your Honor.
What was the error?
The error was that the board didn't consider the disabilities collectively.
And so if it was error, it was either reasonably raised or raised by the veteran.
Yes,
sir. I think that's the question. You're trying to argue that the court was wrong in finding error also?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that this was...
Then by definition, the board should have addressed it and it was reasonably raised.
I'm not sure I'm following. the point, I don't know that if the Secretary raises this, what could be considered a harmless error argument, essentially, on the merits of the case. Possibly he should have, if he didn't. The issue now, though, is was it reasonably raised by the record, reasonably for purposes of substantial justification, given that...
You're saying that the reasonableness for purposes of substantial justification is different than the reasonableness whether or not they should have addressed it. You're saying two different standards of reasonableness?
May I have a moment?
Yes.
You've got 1 minute and 54 seconds.
The test isn't whether it's right or wrong, Your Honor. And I see... there, reasonableness is reasonableness. It hasn't been specifically defined beyond that. It's almost an apples and oranges comparison if you're talking reasonableness, the merits versus the reasonableness.
So in context, you believe reasonableness is different?
Yes, Your Honor, within the context. And to finish answering Judge Peach's question, the reasonable person's definition hasn't been set forth as to the litigating position. One would assume it's, I mean, they just say a reasonable person. They didn't say a reasonable lawyer or reasonable judges. They just say a reasonable person hasn't been defined yet, Your Honor. And then just one more point to address. Mr. Carpenter suggested that the court should overturn years of its case law, addressing the totality of circumstances. The Secretary submitted there's no reason to do that. The totality of circumstances is still the proper test to evaluate in each of the cases. For those reasons, the Secretary submits that the court should deny appellants each application. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
Can you answer the point just made that you're asking this court to overturn years of our case law?
I believe I can, Your Honor. I believe that this court's case law, even beginning with Stilwell, has not stayed anchored on imposing the burden that is incorporated into the statute on the VA. That the VA must come forward first with a showing as to why their position, in this case their litigation position on ambiguity, was reasonable. And although there's been a great deal of discussion by the government about why their position was reasonable, it all goes back to why it was reasonable before this court.
All right, so your view of overturning is that the application of this court has not placed the burden where it belongs?
In part. Also in relationship to this court's unilateral or monolithical consideration of change in law. This court has considered change in law on a statutory basis to be the same as change in law on a judicial basis. There is no change in law when this court interprets a statute or a regulation. That is what the law always was. That's the function of this court, to make those interpretations. I'm sorry.
If we were to, just for our purposes here, assume that we found the agency's administrative position to be substantially justified, so now we're talking about their litigating position, can you go through and respond to the various factors that your opposing counsel raised?
Yes. To begin with, I do not believe that this court should adopt the notion that there isn't a dispositive question as to substantial justification when the VA makes no showing. In other words, the first question this court must ask is what the VA presented in terms of the factors a showing that their position was substantially justified in arguing before this court and before the Federal Circuit that the language, the plain language of 3.321b1 was ambiguous? Because to me, if you find that they have offered no evidence in support of that. That ends the matter.
What kind of evidence would they offer, Mr. Carpenter?
The kind of evidence that they have cited to in their pleading, but in fact do not exist, which would be that there was a published presidential opinion of some court that found that 3.321B was ambiguous. If, as in Owen, at the Federal Circuit's en banc decision in Owen, there was existing precedent that went the other way, that's fine. But this court's interim en banc decision is not existing precedent. It was a decision within the appeal process. They cannot rely upon that, and yet that's precisely what they do rely upon.
Is it precedent while it can still be appealed?
I'm sorry?
Is it precedent while it can still be appealed?
It is.
Are they actually arguing that it's a precedent, or are they arguing that because a majority of judges on this court found a position that they argued to be valid, that that makes them reasonable?
The latter, however, that litigation position is what must be tested. The litigation position is not whether it was reasonable to have taken it. It was in light of the Federal Circuit's rejection of it. Is that position now considered reasonable by a reasonable person? And they have offered nothing in their pleadings to suggest that. And the factors that they have gone through, the genuine dispute, the fact that this court agreed that there is a long-standing legal policy, their M21-1 manual provision, and confusing tapestries, those factors, even if you accept that they have presented to you an argument, do not overcome the ultimate result in this case, which is that the Federal Circuit said, when you read the plain language of the regulation you wrote, VA, that language requires a different outcome than the one that you urged. And none of those factors, the fact that they took those positions, changes or modifies in any way the fact that they were not reasonable in taking that position. Their position was categorically, absolutely, unequivocally rejected.
So you're saying, and I thought you said something differently in my first round of questions, now you're saying that there is one trump card in this deck, and it's what the Federal Circuit determines that their language and the regs say.
I don't know of no case law that says that. What I'm suggesting... What I am suggesting is, if you will, a three-step process. Step one is whether or not the VA has made a show. If they have presented reasons for why the litigation position they took was reasonable in law or fact, then you move on to step two. Step two could be, is a categorical rejection by a higher court the end of the matter? And this court, obviously in Nam, can make that determination. The third level is to go into the totality of circumstances analysis. But the factors that have been announced in the pleading by the government simply do not overcome the formidable hole they're in because of the ultimate result in this case.
Let me ask you this as a hypothetical one, Mr. Governor. What if the Federal Circuit had, on review of Johnson, determined that there was, in fact, ambiguity in the regulation, and it deferred to the agency to interpret its regulation. And then it went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said, whoa, clear on its face. Could the case be made that the litigation position was then substantially justified?
I do not believe so. Well, could the case be made? It certainly could be made.
What if it succeeded? What if there was 9-0 here and you know, en banc at the Federal Circuit, and the Supreme Court said, no, we're right because we're last, and we say we see it differently.
And that they are the law of the land, Your Honor. And the difference is whether or not it is part of the appellate process. If it is part of an ongoing appeal, then a decision from this court, a decision from the Federal Circuit in favor of the government are not existing precedent, except for independence of the appeal, until the Supreme Court acts.
Well, I'm not asking if there are precedents there during an appeal. What I'm asking is, do those decisions get any weight in determining whether or not the position of the government is substantially justified as a litigation position?
First, if they make an argument and point to the court as to why those positions would have been reasonable in fact. And what I'm suggesting is that based on the case law, there are only two objective tests, existing precedent, or in this case, an existing VA General Counsel opinion, because that VA General Counsel opinion would have been a basis for a reasonable position to have been taken. What is absent in this case is any assertion by the government pointing to anything outside of their own interpretation. Essentially, what they're saying to Your Honor is, we were right because we were right. But at the end of the day, the Federal Circuit said they were wrong.
Isn't what they're really saying, we were wrong, but we were reasonable? Isn't that what they're really saying?
That is precisely what they're saying, without offering you one iota of substantiation for why that conclusion is true, other than the fact that they made the interpretation. When you get down to it, their longstanding policy is just about the interpretation that they made. Their manual provision is the same thing. And then they come to this court, and as was discussed with my colleague, well, they really took both positions. It was plain on its face. It was not ambiguous. And we made the correct interpretation based on that plain language. But in the alternative, it's ambiguous, and therefore our interpretation must be deferred to. Going through those constructive tests, this court ultimately adopted the view that the regulation was ambiguous and this court should defer. But those considerations about deferral come in only after you make the ambiguity